Thank you, Alexandra. It's a pleasure for me to briefly introduce Divya. She joined us 1.5 years ago after she finished her PhD at the National Center for Biological Sciences in Mumbai in India. And there she developed a mass spectroscopy method to measure chemicals in the brains of insects, in individual brains, and not only a single chemical. She is measuring several of what she's calling neurochemical signature in insects. Why is this exciting? Many of you may think, well, if you present a stimulus to an insect, then it will respond. And yes, insects are handy in behavioral experiments. You easily can run behavioral experiments and they will respond by escaping, stinging, biting, or sticking out their tongue, things like that. However, they're far from reflex automats. Sometimes they will show the behavior, other times they will not do so. And this, most impressively, I think, can be observed when looking at social insects. When you look at the colony, what you immediately realize is that some are taking care of the brood, others are defending the nest, others go foraging or recruit. And this division of labor is based on individual development, on experience, and it is context dependent. Or in sloppy words, these creatures are moody. So how come that they show this context dependent behavior? What is the underlying mechanism? And the approach Divya took was to look at these neurochemical signatures and with the idea that these signatures correspond to neuromodulation, to changes in information processing, and finally leading to context-dependent decisions. And one major achievement Divya made was her ability to measure not a single component, but many different chemicals. And that's why she is calling it a signature. And well, we think that by screening for these signatures, we can learn much about division of labor in social insects, and in more general terms, about context-dependent decision-making in insects. And with that, I'm handing over to Divya. Enjoy the presentation.
Thank you, Christoph, for that nice introduction. Yes, hello and welcome to my seminar. It's the first time I'm introducing my work to the cluster, and I'm very excited to be here. So as Christoph said, I will be introducing to you the concept of neurochemical signatures and how we can use that to study social insect behavior using the very versatile technique of mass spectrometry. I want to take some time to describe some of the behaviors I think are very unique to social insects. Like Christoph said, social insects have a division of labor. They live in communities where there is only one or a few members of the colony that actually do lay eggs or do the reproduction. And the rest of the colony on any normal day is made up by sterile female workers. And now whatever needs the colony has is taken care of by these workers. And between themselves, they distribute the labor amongst them. And this is indeed the division of labor. Take, for example, foraging. Foraging is done by a group of insects called group of the workers within the colony called foragers. They go out, they collect food, but they don't eat the food themselves. They bring the food back to the nest and then they store it in the nest. And whenever they're hungry, they consume food from the nest. And this division of labor and distribution of tasks among the colony, therefore, also brings about different modes of communication within the colony. And I think most of you would recognize the picture over here. This is the famous waggle dance of honeybees, wherein a bee that has found a food source comes back to the nest and lets her nest mates know that there is food available at this location, at this distance, and is of a quality that she considers to be good. Again, because of the fact that these insects live in a society, they also need to defend their colony. They need to defend their precious brood and the food that they've collected. And sometimes they also defend wherever food is available as their territory. The picture here is of an Asian species of honeybee called Apis serrana. It's a ball of bees. And what they've managed to do is to lure a hornet. And this hornet is their predator. They've managed to lure the hornet inside the colony, and they gather around this hornet and raise their body temperature so much that this hornet is literally cooked alive inside. And there are some social insects that once their queen becomes old or unable to lay as many eggs as she normally would, they fight for who becomes the new queen by establishing reproductive dominance through a series of aggressive behaviors. There's another behavior in social insects, like you can see in this bumblebee, where they actively raise the temperature of their brood, their larvae, their eggs, so that they can develop normally. And this is, again, unique to social insects. Another interesting thing is that sometimes these insects aren't always in the social context. They aren't always in a colony. They establish a colony. So this ant, she's a foundress. She's laid her first set of eggs. She is, at this point of time, not in a social context. She lays the eggs, and once the eggs mature and the adults come out, then she enters the social context. And then they become your regular colony where there's one queen and the rest of the workers are taking care of her. Now, the reason I spend some time discussing or describing these behaviors is because you really can't expect a fruit fly to do these behaviors. And that's unfortunate, because this means that we can't take advantage of the genetic toolkit that comes with fruit flies. We haven't yet been able to create mutants as we'd like we can do with fruit flies. We can't turn off and on a neuron with light that like we can do with fruit flies. So then how do we get to the neural underpinnings of such wonderful behaviors that social insects have? Well, one of the ways is to put a live insect under a microscope or stick an electrode into its brain, like you can see over here, there's a nice electrode going into the brain, and then study whatever behavior you can manage to get out of it under this condition. You can see it's restrained. It can't move anything except perhaps its antenna. And I think when you have an electrode, you also don't want the antenna to move. It's kind of obvious that these behaviors in the back is not going to be performed by an insect under this condition. So how else can you study social insect behavior? Well, in general, the community studies social insect behaviors using post-mortem analysis. So you allow a group of insects to perform a behavior, and then you capture them, kill them, and then you use the brains and see whatever changes has happened within the brain. This, for example, is a figure from a very recent paper that is looking at what gene expression changes are happening in the brain. So they compare interior workers, or workers that stay inside the nest, and foragers, so workers that go out and collect food outside the nest. And they look at what is the mRNA expression, so which genes are differently expressed between these two groups of workers. And you can see, okay, fine, yes, allatostatin A is higher in foragers, corazonin is higher in foragers. And then you base your further hypothesis based on these differences. If you don't want to look at gene expression, you can look at protein expression using Western blots. or you can measure the amount of these chemicals that are there in the brain. And normally it is done using electrochemical methods. The other thing you can do is, of course, treat the insects using the drugs of your choice that you think might affect the signaling systems that are important. Here is an example of a study that treated entire colonies of bees with either MSG or monosodium glutamate or octopamine. And then they found that if you treat entire colonies with these drugs, then the colonies end up with more scouts as compared to those that weren't treated. Now you can treat them by feeding them or applying this chemical on their cuticle or injecting them into the brain directly. But all of these methods are very crude methods because you can't really understand where these drugs are going. Finally, there's only a certain amount of restriction that you can provide even if you inject it directly into the brain. Then, of course, you can go into the brain, section it, and then stain for the chemicals that you're interested in. For example, on the left here is stained with these pinks. The pink spots over here basically tell you what part of the honeybee brain is active when honeybees are flying back and forth from their food source. And on the right is what part of the brain is active when the honeybee wants to fly to the food source, but for example, it's raining and it doesn't do that. So this is one way to get into the brain. You can use immediate early genes. These are a proxy for neural activity. These are the first genes that are transcribed when a neuron is highly active. So then you stain for them in the brain and you hope to find such differences. Or you can use immunohistochemistry, where you stain for the modulator of your interest, dopamine or serotonin, see where it is in the brain, whether it is intensely stained, not so intensely stained, which neuron types is it part of, where does it project into the brain, and so on. Now, all of these methods, one downside is that you can only look at a handful of molecules at once. And these are also only the molecules that you are interested in. So if you study octopamine and glutamate, then those are the only results you're going to get. You're never going to get something new, and you might lose out on other modulators that are involved in this behavior. But we are in the age of omics technology, and omics, as is given in the definition here, it is a collective characterization and quantification of pools of molecules that you then translate into either the behavior or the structure and the function of an organism. And omics, I'm sure you must have heard about it, come in very different types. You have genomics, transcriptomics, proteomics, peptidomics, metabolomics. Within that, you have glycomics, lipidomics, and so on. What I want to do is to bring your attention to the techniques that are used in omics. Apart from studying long sequences of DNA or RNA, the rest of the omics technology uses this technique called mass spectrometry. So what is mass spectrometry? Why is it used for omics studies? How is it able to study large number of molecules from a sample? Well, that's what I'm going to tell you. So mass spectrometry is a detection technique. And what it detects is the ratio between how heavy or the mass of the molecule and what charge is present on the molecule. Now, as long as you can charge a molecule in some way, put it in an acidic medium, add another molecule that has a charge on it, whatever trick, if you can get the molecule to be charged, you can use mass spectrometry. The second thing what is important is that you can do something called tandem mass spec. With this, what I mean is that you take a molecule, you break it down, and then you can identify its parts. And you can do this multiple times. So you can take a molecule, break it down, take one of those parts, break that down, and then study those parts. Why is this important? Well, I'll give you an example. So take a look at these two molecules, dopamine and octopamine. In insect behavior, these are two of the main regulators of behavior. They do very different things, but they have the same mass to charge ratio. Why? Because the only difference is this OH group over here has shifted over there. So the mass is the same, the charge is the same. So the mass to charge ratio is the same. But because you can do tandem mass spec, you can break down the product and then see, well, what does it look like after you break it? And clearly, these are two different molecules. And indeed, this is the reason why mass spec is so highly specific, that you can differentiate so many different compounds, and you can therefore profile thousands of compounds from within one complex sample. And also, over the last few years, mass spec has become extremely sensitive. You can profile within a single cell. And recently, I also read a paper where it said that you can measure compounds from within a single lysosome, that is inside a cell, subcellular. That's how sensitive it is. Funnily, even though mass spec can do all this, and it seems to be this really good tool with which you can study insect behavior, its use as a way to do so is fairly new. It's only started in the last 5 to 6 years or so. Which brings me to what I want to do with mass spec and studying insect behavior, which is looking at neurochemical signatures. What I mean by neurochemical signatures is that it is the quantitative composition of neurochemicals. Not everything present in the brain, not everything present in the neuron, but those chemicals that bring about a change in behavior. So like your neurotransmitters or neuropeptides and so on. So the composition of these neurochemicals in the brain or brain parts, because I expect that represents the behavioral or the physiological state that the organism is in. And so whatever changes would then reflect whatever changes occur in the physiology or the behavior of that organism. To do this, first you need a method, a targeted method, so you know which neurochemicals you're looking at. You need it to be high throughput, and you need it to be easily transferable to other study organisms. You don't want a method that you develop for, say, honeybees and then say, well, it works for honeybees, but it doesn't work for ants because ants are too small. You want it to be able to transfer across different model organisms. And also, you want it at the level of individual insect brains. You want to study the variation in behavior within the collective. And indeed, this is what I did in my PhD. I was working with honeybees. This is the picture of what a frozen and dissected honeybee brain looks like. It has different parts. It has the optic lobe, which is where the visual information comes in. You have the antennal lobe, which is where olfactory information comes in. We have the subesophageal ganglion, which is responsible for feeding and taste. And then you have the rest of the brain, which I call the central brain. And this holds all the parts that are important for higher order processing, like learning and memory, goal-directed behaviors, etc. And I was able to develop a method with which I quantify not only your classical neurotransmitters like octopamine, dopamine, serotonin, tyramine, but also the amino acids that synthesize these transmitters. So you have an idea of the pathway which is used and so on. So now I have this method. I want to tell you what I did with this method and what kind of information you can get from it. So like I said, I was working with honeybees for my PhD, and this is a schematic of a day in the life of a typical forager. Honeybees are diurnal, so they sleep or rest inside the hive at night. And in the morning, a forager decides whether she goes out to collect food or she stays inside the hive. If she decides to go out, she can decide to go to a place where she already knows there is food available, or she can decide to search for a new place. Once she's collected the food, she comes back home, she deposits the food, and then if she thinks that the food is of a good quality, she will inform her nestmates using the dance. And then she makes the decision again whether to go out or stay inside the hive. Now, I had just developed the method and I wanted to have two very different behaviors so that I could say as a proof of principle, my method works. So I decided to look at the difference between bees that are resting or sleeping inside the nest and bees that are getting ready to forage in the morning. The experiment was fairly simple. If you train bees to go out and collect food at a particular time, say 9 in the morning, because they have such an amazing sense of time, they will be ready by 8. They won't fly out, not yet, but they will all gather towards the entrance of the hive and be ready to fly out. They just need some kind of indication that the food is now open and available. So what I did was I trained bees to collect food at 9 in the morning. I marked those bees. And then on the day of the experiment, at night, at 2 a.m., I opened the colony and I collected a group of these foragers. These foragers are resting or they're sleeping inside the hive. And then the next day, I opened the colony again, and then I caught the rest of the foragers. Again, these were all gathered at the entrance. None of them had flown out yet. And so these were what I call the aroused bees or the anticipating bees. And I looked at what was changing in the brain in all of these four different regions. And I also looked at two kinds of foragers, those that collect pollen and those that collect nectar. I had three main questions I wanted to answer. The first one was, of course, do the neurochemical signatures reflect behavioral states? Because this is the main question. And as you can see from this heat map on the left, yes, morning and night bees or aroused and resting bees, they do cluster separately in all of their major brain regions that I tested. Apart from that, we found that there are individual amino acids or amines that also show significant differences. Cool. Now, we have four different brain parts and we know the brain parts cluster separately, but are the changes the same or do you find brain part specific changes? On the table here, we have a list of all the transmitters that showed any change at all. And we have the different brain parts where they showed a change. Red indicates that the levels of these transmitters were high in the morning, and blue indicates that the levels of these transmitters were low in the morning. Right away, you can see that different brain parts showed different changes. Some of them showed more changes, like the antennal lobe here, and some of them showed only a few changes, like the subesophageal ganglion. Another thing was that it wasn't the same system that was showing the changes. As you can see, HA stands for histamine. Histamine changed only in the subesophageal ganglion, not anywhere else. Whereas aspartate seems to be changing all over the brain. So now we have some global changes and some part-specific changes. Another curious result we found was that in the central brain, so the information processing region, the learning and memory part of the brain, we found no changes in your classical transmitters. So no changes in dopamine, octopamine, tyramine, GABA, etc. The only thing that changed was the amino acids that synthesized them. So all of these. The reason we found this result at all was because we were looking at signatures. If we didn't, we would just say, well, nothing changes in the central brain because these are the regular things people study. We assume that this means that they're stockpiling on their precursors so that when they need the neurotransmitters, they can immediately synthesize them. But we don't know it because this is the first time anyone has ever gotten such a result. So this is something we still need to explore. Now, my third question. We have pollen and nectar foragers. Sure, when they're performing the behavior, it's very different. Pollen foragers don't consume pollen. They collect the pollen in their legs in this hairy structure called a pollen basket. But nectar foragers, they take up the nectar through their mouth parts. That's how they determine how concentrated the sugar is, whether it's good quality or not. So yes, when they're actually foraging, they behave differently. But they aren't foraging in my experiment. They're only getting ready to forage. So then, are there forager-specific changes? I'm not going to tell you all the changes I found, just one to give you a sense of the idea of results that we got. This is in the antennal lobe. So this regards olfaction and smells. The orange bars here represent pollen foragers, and the blue bars represent nectar foragers. So all of these chemicals, glutamate, GABA, dopamine, and octopamine, you can see they are significantly higher in pollen foragers in the morning. Now, all of these chemicals are also known to affect how sensitive the antenna is or how sensitive the antennal lobe is in different odors. This makes sense because pollen is extremely smelly. You can smell pollen. However, in the case of nectar foragers, we either didn't find any changes, which is okay because the food that we provided had no scent attached to it. Sucrose doesn't smell either. So no changes make sense. But we also found changes in dopamine, octopamine, and tyramine where the levels went down in the morning. And this is surprising because we have no reason why this should happen in our experiment. But what it tells us is straight away that even though they aren't doing the behavior, there are different systems or the same systems are used in different ways in preparation for foraging. And this is, again, the first time this has been reported because nobody has done this comparison in terms of getting ready to forage. So, like I said, this was an experiment that I wanted to do to see whether or not my method could detect changes in neurochemical signatures. And yes, when you have two groups and you see the differences, everything works fine. But I can also measure them from individual brains. And the whole point is to use individual variation in behavior to study what changes in the brain. And that brings me to my second study. Here we looked at the search behavior of honeybees. And in general, there is only one group of bees that does any kind of search for food. These are scouts. They're called scouts because they go out of the hive to scout for new sources of food. When they find this food, they come back, they let their nestmates know, they hang around a little bit till they have maybe a few nestmates around, and then they leave to go search for another new place of food. This is what they do. So they're in this sort of permanent search state. The other group of bees are the ones that get recruited. So they're called recruits, and they remain loyal to their food. They don't leave it. So they will go back and forth until that food is completely done, exploited. If it gets dark, they go back. Then the next day they come and they keep doing this. So a few years ago, there was a transcriptomic, so gene expression study, that said that the difference between scouts and recruits lies in these, the GABA, the glutamate, and the catecholamine, so dopamine, octopamine, this system. This was the result of their study. What we wanted to know was whether it distinguishes scouts from recruits, or whether it is just something that scouts use while searching and recruits could also use if they had to search. So is it a system that is co-opted for search behavior in general? So what we did was we made recruit search, which was fairly easy. You train bees to go to a feeder. We had it around 300 meters away from the hive. It's a very nice looking feeder, this large multicolored umbrella, like a sun umbrella, a red stool. It's very visually attractive to bees. We train the bees to come there. And after a while, we have a group of bees that keep regularly foraging. So going back and forth, back and forth. And then we caught some bees as they were going out from the hive. Then we call these our control bees. Then we hit the feeder. Once you hide the feeder, the bees that are going out expecting to find food land up and there's nothing there. So then they start searching. It's generally not something that happens in nature that they'll go there and suddenly there's no food. So this is something that we induce them to do. So when they start searching, they make these typical small search flights around where they thought there should be food. And then the radius of search increases. After a while, they get tired. They go back home. Some of them decide that's it. They're not going to search anymore. Some of them are a little more persistent. So they keep flying back and forth. What we did was for the 1 hour that we hit the feeder, we caught bees as they were performing different search flights. So as they were leaving the hive to go search for food, we caught them. And then after an hour, we put the feeder back. Those that were still searching, they found the feeder. And after a while, they're gone back to their regular back forth to the hive and to the feeder. So we had in general 4 categories of bees, the first being your regular foragers, the second being those that have decided, okay, I've not found any food, so I am going to search. So they've started to go out on their first search flight after experiencing that there is no food for the first time. Then we have bees that were caught during their next and other search flights. And then we have bees that once the feeder was put back, they've started foraging again. And like before, we divided the brain into these different regions, but we chose not to look at the antennal lobes because, again, we didn't have any scent in the feeder, so we weren't interested in what was changing. And we didn't look at the subesophageal ganglion because while bees are searching, they're not getting any reward. So we didn't look at these two brain regions. We were interested in what happens in the optic lobe because, like I said, it was a huge, visually attractive field, and what happens in the central brain, the information processing region. First, we just looked at these broad categories. So this, the plot on the left, the plots on the left are the changes that we found in the central brain. Let me rephrase. These are the only changes we found in the central brain. GABA and glutamate levels decrease once the bees enter the search state. And GABA and glutamate were also the same systems that were supposedly different between scouts and recruits. So point one for us. What about the optic lobes? There were no search-related changes in the optic lobes, just like there were no reinitiation-related changes in the central brain. These are representative graphs of GABA and glutamate. I didn't add all of the changes that happened, but there were a lot of changes, and they were all in the precursors. So the amino acids that give rise to the neurotransmitters, a result that is similar to my previous study. And it was a drastic increase in the levels of these compounds. They increased to a level that was even more than our control foraging bees. Interesting. Second, we had individual behavioral data. We knew how many foraging flights each bee had made, how long each search flight lasted, how much time did each bee spend inside the hive after each of its search flights. So we wanted to see, well, we have these individual behavioral data. Do all bees search the same way, or do they have different search phenotypes? So this figure on the left, slightly complicated. The gray bars, they tell the amount of time that a bee spent searching. And the brown bars, they tell you the amount of time that a bee spent inside the hive after searching. If there's only one, it means a bee went out on one search flight, then it stayed inside the hive for that much amount of time. And then when it came out again, we caught it. This bee has performed one search flight, stayed inside the hive for a short period of time, searched again, stayed inside the hive for a short period of time, searched again, and when it came out, we caught it. Two things are immediately obvious. The first is that there are different kinds of search phenotypes. Even in bees that only performed one search flight before it got caught, for example, cluster 3A and cluster 1, the way they performed it is different. So even though outwardly, if you would score it as one search flight, if you actually look at the behavior, there are at least two kinds. The second thing that is obvious is that when you compare different colonies, so 2017 and 2018, we had two different colonies. I'm only showing you data from two out of the three that we used. You can already see that not all of the clusters or not all of the phenotypes are found in all of the colonies. So different colonies seem to have a foraging force that searches in different ways. Now we have these different search phenotypes. Do we also then find something in the neurochemicals because of this difference? And indeed, we do. So in each of these plots, the clusters from left to right indicate how intensely a bee has searched. Cluster 1 and 3A, bee has performed only one search flight, as you can see here. 3E just performed 2 search flights, then 3C just performed 3 search flights. And you can see that DOPA is what creates dopamine. DOPA increases in the central brain as bees perform search more intensely, or as bees persist in searching. Same thing with histamine. The result from histamine is actually even more significant than the one in DOPA. The only reason we see this result at all is because we have histamine as part of our study. Most people don't. And in octopamine, we see it's the opposite. As bees search more intensely, the levels of octopamine in the central brain drop. Now, what's interesting again is that dopamine and octopamine are again the same systems that were previously reported to be different between scouts and recruits. So all in all, what we conclude is that task specialists, like scouts and recruits, they tend to use the same systems for a behavior, at least for search behavior. Perhaps this is true in the case of solitary insects as well. We don't know, but it could be. Second, GABA and glutamate for search behavior seems to decide whether or not an insect even decides to search, so to get into the search state. Whereas octopamine and histamine and dopamine, for example, might modulate how information is being processed once it is within that context. We haven't done pharmacological experiments, of course, but this is the kind of data that we get from neurochemical studies. And this paper was very recently accepted and published in Frontiers in Insect Science. And if you want to see what other results we got from this, because this is a very short description, I'd suggest you go read it up. So just before I conclude, I want to say I've been in Constance for 1.5 years, like Christoph said, and I have been trying to establish my mass spec method over here while performing other behavioral experiments. And I have to say that it's almost completely done, and we should be getting our real sample data within the next month. So we have in Constance now a method with which we can study neurochemical signatures. So where do I want to go from here? Being in Constance, being part of the cluster, being part of the neurobiology department. Where do I want to establish myself as a researcher? I am interested in studying what I call the signatures of sociality. And I want to do this using a comparative approach. I have a little schematic here just to outline what this might look like, because it's a very, very broad topic. But this is where I'd like to go establish myself as a researcher in the future. You have social species that are obligatorily social, like honeybees. They cannot survive without a community at any point of time. Then you have what I call transitionary species. These are insects that found their colony, and at that point of time, they are solitary. And once they found their colony and their first batch of eggs hatch and adult workers come out, then they enter a social state. And then you have purely solitary insects that only fend for themselves, they feed for themselves, and if they want to reproduce, they lay their eggs, they provide for their eggs, and go on with their lives. What I want to do is to study different kinds of behaviors that I consider are common between them. Take foraging, for example. Solitary insects forage. When they forage for nectar or energy-rich food, they forage for themselves, but they do also forage for protein-rich food for their offspring. In a transitionary species, in the beginning, they are like solitary insects, but then they enter the social state. And social insects never forage for themselves. They only forage for the sake of the colony. So I want to study this behavior using neurochemical signatures. And I consider whatever is common with all these signatures should be because of the behavior itself. Like GABA and glutamate is likely used for search itself. I would say that anything common is likely used for that behavior itself. And whatever is different is because of this added layer of sociality, of being within a social context. Of course, this is a lot of data. A lot of computational energy will go into this. And because I'm now part of the cluster and I know there are so many people here who can help me out with this, I think I'm in a very good place for this to become a reality. Of course, it's not only neurochemical signatures. I have to go deeper. I want to go deeper into studying what is different within the brain. And so I will be looking at staining studies, pharmacology, and other molecular biology techniques, like I mentioned before. And I'm in a very good position to do that because I'm also part of the neurobiology department. So this is where I want to go. And I think I'm in a very good place where this is feasible and possible for me to do. And with that, I'd like to conclude my talk by giving thanks to the cluster for allowing me to have this talk and introduce myself and my work. I'd like to thank Professor Berkeley and Mangare and Sara for helping me access and use the mass spectrometer in their lab. Of course, also Professor Marx and Mayo and Matthias for helping me use some of the other equipment that I want. My PhD lab at NCBS India with Dr. Axel Brockman, and of course, my new colleagues and peers at the neurobiology department with whom I don't have a group picture yet, but I hope to have one soon. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Can I jump in and ask a question? Thanks for the talk, Divya. Some really cool results. It's really interesting you see these differences. I guess you would expect differences in the brain for individuals involved in different tasks, such as foraging and also specifically pollen foraging. Have you looked at or have you wondered, do you have some idea how this is related to developmental trajectories? For example, like the age of the individuals in developing these systems? Or is it more related to the task that they're doing at hand? Like, what is driving this? Is it developmental state, which is age growing over time, or is it actually the tasks that they're involved in?
So this is interesting. So there's been work that looked at, not with neurochemical signatures, of course, or phylogenetic means, but there's work that looked at how sensitive young bees, so nurse bees, are to different concentrations of sucrose. And there's a prediction that those that become pollen foragers differ in their sucrose sensitivity to nectar foragers. So there's supposedly already something that happens quite early in their age that differentiates between them. So I guess it would be a combination of both the task at hand, because foragers, though they do tend to be sort of stuck to the kind of food they collect, they can also switch between nectar and pollen depending on the colony state. So it's a combination of both developmental as well as what they're doing at the moment, as well as what the colony needs.
Yeah, that would be really interesting if there actually are some signatures of for which developmental trajectory individuals would take.
Yep.
Kind of early in this.
But the problem is once you sample them, you can't really go back to them later. So once you sample them when they're young, then they're gone. we can't wait till they become adults. I mean, well, older adults.
So Divya, thank you for that presentation, amazing data. I wonder, this technology, is it the way I understand that you describe it, is you are looking for substances that you think are important. Is it possible to use it also to discover new substances, maybe new transmitters or new neurochemicals that we weren't expecting? And is that only possible if you target your experiment to do that, or could you go into old data and look for signatures, unknown signatures that would open up maybe, I don't know, new venues?
Okay, so there are quite a few answers to this. If we want to discover something new, then the targeted way to go is probably not the way to do it. So if it was something that is a new transmitter, then we would probably have to just do a profiling study or something that combines profiling. So which is basically getting a list of everything that is there in the brain and seeing if anything changes and then go from there. So an untargeted approach would be better if you want to discover something completely new. But if you want to maybe figure out a new function of an already existing transmitter, then a targeted approach is fine, which is another reason why you need...
Targeted approach is more sensitive.
Targeted approach is more... a targeted quantitative approach... Okay, so there is a compromise you need to get between if you're just trying to see if something is there or not versus if you want to see how much of something is there. So when you only want to say a yes or no, that is way more sensitive than if you want to quantify it, because you need to have the signal to be much higher than just if it's yes or no. So it's a compromise. So all these studies that say they get information from single cell results, it is all usually qualitative data saying that, yes, I can say glucose is there, other kinds of chemicals are there, but the amount of things they can actually quantify is a much smaller subset of that. So if we do an untargeted study, then we can discover new chemicals that might be involved in a behavior. If we do a targeted study, then we can find new functions of chemicals of behavior. So it's you have to do it both ways, I would say.
Thank you.
Yes.
This is nice talk. Thank you. And then I have a... I'm not familiar to this field, so it might sound silly question, but is your neurochemical signatures sensitive enough to tell like a specific memory for a specific event, like the food location or some presence of predator or something? Then I assume that maybe you can trace that in when they're sleeping or something, when they're resting. So like you can develop a whole new field for the studying dream or something in insect.
Okay, so I have to say that we won't know if it is sensitive enough or not until we choose such behaviors. So if we want to distinguish between what's happening in the brain when a bee is dreaming versus when it's in a earlier stage of sleep, perhaps, we won't know whether my method is sensitive enough to detect these changes until we do it. But what I can tell you is that the smaller the brain part that we take for the analysis, the more likely it is that we will be able to detect these changes. So if we are able to say that this happens only in the mushroom bodies and we're able to cut out the mushroom bodies, then we are more likely to see it than if we just take a large part of the brain. So it's a little bit of trial and error. Also, because these chemicals change very rapidly, we have to freeze the brain or the insect quickly, and we can never allow it to thaw. So we won't be able to tell what kind of signaling is happening. So we won't be able to tell if a neurotransmitter is being released or not. It's just whatever is present within the brain at that time, inside the cell, outside the cell. So what we can do, however, is if you can get small quantities of the synaptic fluid or the extracellular fluid and then analyze that, then we can see if the instrument is sensitive enough to detect the chemicals and if something changes. So it's the question of how you use the method and how you get your sample to see what you want to see. In theory, it can be done, but it depends on what your sample is.
So Divya, you briefly mentioned pharmacology and you did not go into, well, you did not propose any experiments with pharmacology as far as I've seen. So you would expect that by using such an approach, applying oral or by injection, whatever pharmacological treatment, you would screw the signature you're measuring. Have you ever done so? Looking at the effect of a drug on the neurochemical signature, the way you're measuring it?
Has not been done yet, but I already have some samples that need to go into the instrument. So this is with ants and whether or not they choose a particular concentration of sugar and how a treatment with, say, dopamine affects their choice. So I have the samples. Whether or not the treatment with this pharmacological treatment affects the neurochemical signatures is something I should have the data in the next couple of months. But it hasn't been done yet, but we will have the data soon.
Because this is one of the major critics in this approach. Thank you. So I would say we close the session for today and see you all next Monday to the seminar. Thank you very much again, Divya.
Thank you.